Okay, good morning, everybody. Just before we start with a little bit of meditation this morning, something that came up yesterday was people were asking about recommended reading that they can do. What we've decided to do is I'm going to send a short list of some recommended reading to Land of Joy, and they're then going to post it up on the resources page for this course. So you will all be able to access that. It might not go up until tomorrow, I suspect, but you will be able to access that later in the week. But I'm just going to go very, very quickly through the books that I'm going to recommend. These are just some ideas. There are so many good Dharma books, and particularly with a subject like we're looking at here, there's so many good books. And when once we've set up an email group, some of you might want to share your own recommendations as well, and I'd very, very much encourage that. These are just some ideas from me, and I don't want people to feel that I'm saying you ought to buy all of these. Yeah, they're just some ideas, and yeah, you'll find some of them more helpful than others. The first two I'm going to recommend, and these you can actually obtain free via the Lama Yeshe Wisdom Archive. If you Google, you can Google the book titles or the Lama Yeshe Wisdom Archive, and you should be able to find these. I think they're actually available together with both these two books together. They ask if you want to, you can make a donation, but they are free. It's entirely up to you that. One is called Becoming Your Own Therapist by Lama Yeshe. And the other one is called Making Your Mind an Ocean. And a lot of people think they're quite short. They're easy to read. A lot of people find these books very, very helpful. Lama Yeshe, as I explained yesterday, was actually the original founder and spiritual director of the FPMT. And he was Lama Zopa's teacher, an incredibly inspiring teacher and practitioner. And yes, Susan, you were going to ask a question. Sorry, you need to unmute yourself, Susan.
I got Becoming Your Own Therapist. What was the other one?
Make your mind an ocean.
Make Your Mind Emotion.
An ocean. Yeah, that's it.
Right. Thank you.
We actually checked this morning, and they offer them together. The two books, so they're quite easy to order. Okay, now the other book, which I am going to plug, and some of you probably already have this, it's become a bit of a joke at Jamyang Bath, where I teach regularly, how often I plug this book. But it's called How to Meditate by Kathleen McDonald, otherwise known as Sangay Kadro. I mean, I really would recommend if people don't have this, at least have a look at it if you've got access to a Dharma library. It's a really, really good book to have. And particularly for anyone who's wanting to set up a meditation practice. There are wonderfully clear explanations, lots of different types of meditation, including the ones we're doing this weekend, and lots of others. And there are also really nice, clear descriptions of important Buddhist ideas like impermanence, which we looked at yesterday, emptiness, and thought transformation, which we're going to look at a little bit later on today, and so on. And there's also some very, very practical advice on dealing with difficult emotions. And troublesome mental state. So that one I would particularly recommend. Now, the others that I'm going to put on the list, and this is for people if they want to go a little bit more deeply into the things we looked at yesterday, the Four Noble Truths, and also Buddhist psychology. These are by Geshe Tashi, who was one of my teachers. He was the resident teacher at Jamyang London for many, many years. He's now the Abbot of Sera in India, big monastery in India. And he actually wrote these to go side by side with a course called Foundation of Buddhist Thought. And there are six books actually from that course, but this is two of them. One is book one, which is on the Four Noble Truths, which goes much, much further. Claire's waving it around there. So I'm sure you'd recommend it also, wouldn't you, Claire? There you go. And the other one, which is, I think, volume three. Yes, it is. It's book three, which is on Buddhist
Yeah,
psychology.
come on, Claire.
Have you got that one as well, Claire?
She's looking, she's
Well, you've obviously
looking,
got it anyway.
she's
That's great.
looking.
I mean, a lot of us have quite a strong connection with Geshe Tashi. He's a wonderfully clear teacher, particularly very good. There you go, Claire's got all of them, yeah. Wonderfully clear, and he's very, very good at making it practical and accessible, for practice for Westerners. And then the only other book I was going to put on the list. And again, this is one I really enjoy. There are actually a few of these. This one's called Mind Science, an East-West Dialogue by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. But it's actually, this came about as a result of a symposium at Harvard in America, which was arranged very much with the encouragement of His Holiness. And it involves Buddhists, including His Holiness, with experts from various fields, including neuroscience, psychotherapy, psychology, having discussions about and comparing, if you like, the more Western scientific understanding of the mind and how that fits in with the Buddhist understanding. Again, it's a really, really interesting read. And there are other similar books to this as well, but that's one I've got that I particularly enjoyed. So again, that's Mind Science and East-West Dialogue. Okay, but I'll be putting all those on the list. And once we've set up an email group, if you want to share your own recommendations, obviously that'd be great. That's, we're all different, so we find some more helpful than others. Okay, so we'll do a little bit of meditation now. So we get ourselves nice and comfy. I'm not going to go through posture in the way that I did yesterday. You can refer back to that on the recording, and it's also in that little meditation guide that I sent out with the course resources. So again, the main thing is that you're nice and comfy. And then particularly important that you've got a nice straight back. It's always good to check that. Again, without forcing anything. Once you've settled a little bit, make sure you feel nice and grounded and relaxed. Again, let's turn our attention onto the natural rhythms of our breathing. And noticing those subtle sensations as you breathe in and your diaphragm moves down, the air enters your body. Again, as the diaphragm moves back, expelling the air, moving up, out of that point of the nostrils, again, noticing the subtle sensations of air as the air leaves your body. And again, we're going to hone in at that point at the nostrils. Just a hint generally, when you're doing this practice, if your mind is particularly agitated, you're becoming easily distracted, it can actually be helpful to focus at a lower point in the body, such as the navel or the diaphragm. If, on the other hand, our mind is more lethargic, a bit sleepy, feeling a bit dull, it can be helpful to focus at a high point in the body, which is what we're doing here, at the nostrils. But that's something you can work with when you're doing this practice on your own. And you'll find that changes at different times of the day, different times of your life. We can be more subject to either excitement or laxity, it's sometimes called, or dullness. For now, we're going to focus at that point at the nostrils. Noticing those subtle sensations. And if you become distracted, don't worry about it. Just notice it when it occurs. Just let those distractions dissipate away. Place your attention in a nice, relaxed way back at that point at the nostrils. We'll just do that quietly together for a few minutes. Okay, now we're just going to turn our attention to our motivation for being here today. As I mentioned yesterday, the best kind of motivation we can have from a Mahayana Buddhist point of view is called bodhicitta. That's the altruistic intention to become enlightened so we can be the most benefit for all sentient beings. Let's reflect how we're not doing this just to help ourselves, although that's important, which is something we're going to be discussing today. That is important. You matter as much as everybody else. It's also to put us in a better position to be able to truly benefit others. Okay, the first session this morning, we're going to be looking at ways of dealing with troublesome mental states. And the way we're going to do this, I'm going to first of all talk through some approaches, some of which are traditionally recommended in Buddhism. Others have evolved, to be honest, through actually teaching this and discussing this with students in classes. And I'm going to go through that just to give people some ideas. But we're then going to do it in discussion. I'm going to talk about it specifically with regard to anger. But you might well, I mean, we're all different. Some people have more of a problem with anger. With others, it could be other things. It could be jealousy. It could be depression. It could be fear. There's all sorts of things. It could be extreme attachment, you know. And I would very much encourage people, when we get to discussions, to bring into that things that you feel are particularly important to yourself and that you'd like to deal with. And I'll be encouraging you, partly influenced by what I said, just to get the ball rolling and to give you some ideas, but to share ways that you found helpful, you know, in the past, dealing with problems and difficulties. It can be extremely beneficial, this, just sharing ideas like this. You know, because everybody here, I'm pretty sure from talking to you, it seems to me quite a spiritually mature group, this. And I'm sure that people, everybody in their own way, has had a certain amount of success with this kind of thing. So don't feel shy. Don't feel too modest either. You know, really feel free to share that stuff, you know, when we get to that point. But just before we get to anger, I just want to talk a little bit more about guilt, which was something we touched on yesterday. And I think it's quite important that guilt, from a Buddhist point of view, is an afflictive emotion, and it can actually be a very, very damaging one. And quite a lot of people have problems with this. Some people often say it's particularly a problem in our culture. I mean, maybe that's true. I'm not sure, you know, that other cultures don't have such a big problem with guilt. But certainly I know a lot of people, you know, who've experienced quite a lot of difficulty with this. And it's very important, as I explained yesterday, though, from a Buddhist point of view, to understand the difference between guilt and regret, which is considered to be positive. Yeah. And I think it's probably important, therefore, to define them. Guilt is all about dwelling on our actions in the past and feeling crappy about ourselves and putting ourselves down. It's orientated around a very, very solid notion of I, which was something we talked about yesterday as being the thing that's really at the root of all our problems from a Buddhist point of view. And it doesn't do any good. All it does is make us beat ourselves up, and feel crap about ourselves. At its worst, it could kind of lead to the kind of thought or feeling that I deserve to suffer. And from a Buddhist point of view, that's extremely damaging. Nobody deserves to suffer from a Buddhist point of view. Everybody deserves happiness. That's a really important idea in Buddhism. We don't necessarily achieve it due to ignorance of the other afflictions, but we all deserve that. Nobody actually deserves to suffer. Regret, on the other hand, is considered very positive. And regret is about simply acknowledging that a certain action, whether it be of body, speech, and mind, is unhealthy, unwholesome, negative, within an understanding of karma and cause and effect, and it leads to a resolve to actually try to change it and do something positive about it. And that's considered a very, very positive thing, and it's very, very important. Now, a little bit like love and attachment, these two things can get very, very mixed up in our mind. And quite often there's a bit of both. That's similar with love and attachment, which we're going to talk about later. It gets mixed up, but it is really, really good to be aware of the dangers of guilt and the benefits of regret. If we are feeling bad about things from our past, which quite a lot of us do, there's always something we can do about it from a Buddhist point of view. We're not stuck with it. There are certain practices, which I mentioned, I think it was in response to a question you asked yesterday, Susan. There are certain practices called purification practices in Buddhism, which are very, very effective with this. And they can help us to overcome the effects of bad karma that we've created in the past. They're very, very powerful practices, those, and they're actually recommended for everybody as preliminary practices in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. Lama Zopa is very, very strong at recommending practices, such as Vajrasattva, for instance. Some of you are familiar with these and some not, I realise that. But these are very, very specific practices that are aimed at purification, by overcoming the negative effects in our mind stream of bad karma. Vajrasattva is one. There's prostrations to the 35 Buddhas. There's Nyungne retreat, which if people want to do some really intensive practice, I'd very much recommend it. It's very, very powerful. And I think what a lot of people find, and it's certainly my experience, if you persevere with those practices, they can have a really, really beneficial on your mind. They really help to clear your mind and make it more serviceable for developing all the other qualities that we're trying to develop in our Buddhist practice. But even at a simpler level, that's not the only way of purifying those practices. Just doing something virtuous, something kind, can actually be very, very helpful in this regard. The basic principle of purification, I know it's a bit of a loaded word, purification, but that's all it means. It means helping to clear the mind from the negative effects of previous actions. The basic principle is that it starts with genuine regret and an intention to improve moving into the future. There's genuine regret for the action, just acknowledging it within karma, and then it's concluded by a resolve to do better next time. That's the basic principle. And you can incorporate this into really all your acts of kindness and the virtuous things you do. It could be through your work. I mean, like with Zoe being a nurse, it could be through volunteer work. It could be acts of kindness with your family. And all of these can contribute to that effect and helping to overcome the effects of bad karma in the past and creating good karma moving into the future. When it comes to guilt specifically, if we have regrets or we're feeling guilty about situations with people particularly, obviously the most effective thing, if you have the chance, is to actually sort it out with the person. I think that goes without saying, but it can get a bit skewed this sometimes. I mean, to give an example, if I have an argument with Sarah, obviously my wife, we have arguments sometimes, like most partners do, and I speak harshly to Sarah, the way of purifying the effects of that wouldn't be to go up to the other end of our house and do a few Vajrasattva mantras. Yeah, that wouldn't be the best way to purify that. Obviously, it would be to resolve it with Sarah and to apologise and talk it through with her. So if we can, obviously, we can put things right like that. It's not always possible with that, though. Some people have quite a lot of guilt related to things in their past. It could be with parents, for instance, and things like that. And they might even have died. So they might feel that they can't do anything about it now and they're just stuck with it. But from a Buddhist point of view, you can always do something about it. And one way I would suggest with something like that is use it to motivate you to do something positive and see that as using it in a positive way. And I'll just give one little example of that from my own life. is when I was younger, when I was a kid, I used to go fishing quite a lot. And used to enjoy fishing just as a sport, not for food. Now, that involves inflicting quite a lot of suffering. There's no question about that. And it is something that I wouldn't dream of doing now. It would be anathema to me now to do something like that for pleasure. And it still comes back to me sometimes, the memories of the fish coming up with hooks in the mouth and flapping around and the kind of suffering I was inflicting at that time. But the way I use that is to, I mean, I can't do anything to help those fish that I, that obviously I inflicted that suffering on, what would it be, 40 years ago. What I can do is use it to motivate me to be as kind as I possibly can to animals now. And I kind of think of that as helping to purify and overcome that. That's just one example from my life, but it's really important from a Buddhist point of view. There's always something we can do. We can always use things in a positive way. And you can use similar things if you've had problems with parents, family, and you know, things like that in a similar kind of way. Are there any questions on that before I move on and start talking about anger? Is that clear, the distinction between guilt and regret, as I've explained it there? Yeah, because it is quite important that. We talked a lot yesterday about being in the present. Yeah, and that's very, very important if it's understood in the right context. When we're talking about things like calm body meditation or practicing mindfulness, it's very important, this idea of trying to be more in the present. But it is important, and Geshe Tashi used to emphasize this quite a lot, Buddhism isn't just about being in the present. Buddhist practice is also about taking responsibility for the past and trying to move positively into the future and improving. I think that's quite important. I mean, I had a discussion with somebody a while ago who was using the notion that it wasn't a Buddhist, it was somebody who's read quite a lot of Western philosophy, who was using the idea of being in the present as an argument for never, ever apologising to anyone. Because this was their argument. Oh, well, if you're apologising, you're living in the past and you just need to be in the present. I mean, for me, that is getting things completely skewed. I think probably everybody would agree with that. But we do have to be careful with this idea of living in the present. It doesn't mean that we're not, as I say, taking responsibility for the past and trying to improve moving into the future. Okay, so I'll move on now to anger. Now, can you put the handout up now, Faye, which is H4? Lovely, thanks. Right, you all have access to this. It's been uploaded on the resources page for the course, so you'll be able to refer to this anytime you want. This list here is something I put together following a class we did in Jamia Bath on dealing with anger, and the students asked for this afterwards. A couple of the ideas on this actually came as a result of that discussion. So for me, this is constantly evolving. And there might well be ideas people come up with in the discussion day today that I'll add to this list. I'm going to go through this quite quickly. I could do a long teaching on this, but I don't really want to because I want to encourage us to discuss this. So I'm going to flick through this quite quickly. I mean, every one of these points you could really look at for 20 minutes, but I'm not going to do it like that. And a lot of this actually transfers on dealing with other things. I mean, if you're dealing with jealousy, a lot of the similar things apply, for instance. They're due to dealing with depression as well, but we'll address that a little bit more later. But so the first one, moving to point one, is to reflect on the disadvantages of succumbing to anger, both for oneself and others. When it comes to the practical application of Buddhist psychology, this is a really, really important step. And it's very, very easy to leave this one out. We might feel that we already know the disadvantages of anger. And we probably do at some level. But the point is, we have to convince ourselves at a really, really deep level of our mind. What I would suggest, and this is certainly when, as I've experienced it, when you're actually in the zone, as it were, with anger and being angry, at that time, it's very, very easy to justify it. And it can seem like it's a reasonable reaction to what's happening. Well, of course I'm angry. Look at the way my computer's behaving. Of course I'm angry. Look at the way this person's treating me. You know, it's very, very easy to justify it. By reflecting on the disadvantages, and this is something where if we've got a particular problem we're trying to deal with, this is something we're encouraged to do in meditation. I do have a little bit of experience of this. It can make us much, much more mindful when something like anger is arising, and we'll catch it much, much sooner. It helps with the mindfulness. And then we can start applying the other antidotes. And that's certainly been my experience. Anger was the first thing I asked Geshe Tashi about when I took refuge with him in the 90s. And this was the only practice he gave me to do at the start. He encouraged me to do that at the start of the day as part of my morning practice, was just reflect on the disadvantages of anger. And I must admit, at the time, I walked away from meeting him thinking, well, what is that it? Because I had a lot of respect for other things he taught me, I tried it, and it really, really did make a difference. And as I say, it was helpful in catching it much earlier. And this applies to all the troublesome mental states, afflictive emotions we're going to be looking at this morning. So with regard to anger, I mean, the first thing is look at the immediate effects of anger on your mind and body. Is your mind, and most of these are rhetorical, I'm just going to go through them, I think people agree. But is your mind peaceful and happy or disturbed and discontented? Are you able to think clearly, make intelligent decisions? Or does your thinking tend to become confused and irrational? Do you feel calm and relaxed, agitated, tense? I mean, biochemically out of balance, that's how I feel if I get very, very angry. It's really quite unpleasant. You get a bad taste in your mouth. And there's obviously lots of scientific evidence of the problems that can arise as a result of a lot of anger. It can start affecting your physical health and start affecting your life expectancy and things like that. So that's the first part, is looking at the effects of it on yourself. And then look at the effect it has on the people around you. And this one's particularly important with anger. And it's one of the reasons why anger is considered so harmful, karmically, from a Buddhist point of view. I mean, it can cause you to hurt people you feel close to, and certainly negatively affect positive relationships. It can cause you to exasperate problems with people you find difficult and just make things worse. Generally, it doesn't help. It can also lead to them wanting to come back and hurt you more in the future. Again, that's partly how karma works, of course. And it's a good thing to bear in mind. There are also much, much more subtle disadvantages based on understandings of things like cause and effect, which is karma. The fundamental origin of all our problems, which we looked at yesterday, particularly when we look at self-centeredness of ignorance. Something I mentioned yesterday is generally when we're feeling angry, there's a very, very strong sense of a solid I here and a separate world out there, of a separation between yourself and other beings. And it's actually enhancing the very causes of your own suffering, as well as obviously putting you in a worse position in relation to others. And it's also a major obstacle to developing qualities like love and compassion and wisdom. Which is obviously the real point of the Buddhist path as a whole, if we go that way, of our lives as a whole. So that's the first part, which is reflecting on the disadvantages. And as I said, it is very, very easy to think, oh, well, what's the point of that? I already know. I really would encourage people to work with that. And it might not be anger, it might be with something. It's the same with depression, because it's very easy to sort of justify it when we're experiencing it. And we have to really, really understand the disadvantages, in terms of our long-term development. It's very, very common methodology in Buddhism that if it's something negative that we're trying to reduce or remove, we reflect on the disadvantages. If we're doing something positive, I brought this in a bit with the meditation yesterday when we're doing mindfulness of breathing, reflecting on the benefits of that kind of practice and developing that kind of mental clarity and concentration. But the more we understand, because this is important in Buddhism, we're not encouraged to do things out of just blind faith. So the more we understand the benefits of doing what we're doing, the more likely we are to really throw joyous effort into the practice. So that's the first part. And then moving on to the second bit, which is point two, Can you scroll that up, Faye? Thanks ever so much. Cheers. The second bit, now, again, this is extremely important. So we've already talked about this a bit. But it's being gentle with yourself. Give yourself a break. Don't expect too much of yourself. In fact, being hard on ourselves can be a very, very common cause of anger. And that in turn affects others. One of my favourite quotes from Lama Yeshe, and this used to be written up on the canteen wall at Jamyang London, is be gentle with yourself and you'll be gentle with others. And I think it's a really good, important thing to reflect on that sometimes. And we did touch on this yesterday. We can often be very, very hard on ourselves and expect too much of ourselves. And that can lead to a lot of problems. Another aspect is, are you focusing on the negative side of your life more than the positive? Again, we all do have a tendency to do that, or most of us do, probably. The meditation that Sarah did yesterday on appreciating our human life can be very, very helpful with that. And I'd encourage people to work with that. Okay, so moving on to point three. Anger is more likely to arise if we're feeling unhappy or dissatisfied generally. Part of this is checking our overall state of health. And we talked yesterday about how, from a Buddhist point of view, the root causes of suffering are always within our own mind. But that doesn't mean we neglect external causes and problems. They contribute. And if we can change them, we do. And our state of health and how we look ourselves after ourselves physically is a very, very important part of that. Just being aware as well. I mean, most of us go through times when we're particularly tired or stressed. You might have low blood sugar. I've put on their hormonal problems, and I think it's important to say I'm not just talking about women when I say that, because I know women have that particularly to deal with, obviously, in the course of their lives, which can be quite difficult. Sarah's convinced I've got a cycle around the moon with my moods, and she might well be right. I think a lot of ways she knows me better than I do, but it's good to be aware of that, and because at times when we are physically down, we're more likely to kick off and react to things in a negative way, and it's good. Again, it's an aspect of mindfulness, that really, and being aware of that, and look after yourself. You might need a holiday, you might need a break. It's very, very important. Also, time pressure can be a big one, and particularly in our world, I think a lot of us feel we're constantly busy and pressured with time. It's something to get, but be very, very wary of that, because it can just become a state of mind and a habit, thinking like that. But as I put there, at least be aware of things, and you might need to pay some attention to them, which can either be looking after your health, having a holiday, having a break, and so on. Right, the fourth one there on this list is reflecting on cause and effect, and this is particularly karma. We haven't got time on this course to talk a lot about karma because it is a huge subject. I mean, Susan was asking some very good questions about karma yesterday. But the really important thing with karma is that it's encouraging us to take more responsibility for what's happening to us rather than trying to blame others. That's really the upshot of karma, if we apply it properly. So that's something, again, to bear in mind and try and take responsibility. Try to be less inclined to always try and blame external things or other people, you know, when we're experiencing problems. OK, do you want to scroll down then? Sorry, up. Thank you. Now, point five on this one is, it says here, embracing the apparently negative situation as a positive opportunity to apply practice. I'm going to talk about this a little bit later about in the context of thought transformation, so I won't talk too much about that now. But from a Buddhist point of view, the kinds of situations that are likely to give rise to anger can actually be very, very good times to work on developing positive qualities. Things like patience, equanimity, humility, loving kindness. And one thing we're often encouraged to do is to think of difficult people as our spiritual teachers. That isn't always easy. But sometimes it can really, really turn around a situation that. And it turns it into an opportunity as opposed to just something we're averse to. It's not easy, this stuff. It's important, this. And I'll address this again later. And we have to, be realistic and gentle. What we're never encouraged to do from a Buddhist point of view is allow others to treat us like a doormat. That can be very harmful. So again, we have to apply this stuff skillfully and realistically, but it can be enormously effective that in certain situations. The next 2 points, 6 and 7, are kind of linked. And I've already talked about some of this. I'm not going to go through the detail here. But reflecting on impermanence and also emptiness or selflessness can be very, very effective again when we're experiencing something like anger. I mean, are things really as solid as important as they appear? If we check our experience, there are all sorts of things that we got very agitated about in the past that don't seem very important to us now at all. And reminding ourselves of that sometimes when we're actually in something that seems like a really big deal can be very, very helpful. Another one with impermanence is reflecting on the inevitability of death and the uncertainty of its timing. One thing from a Buddhist point of view is we don't really want to die with anger in our mind. That's considered potentially quite negative and harmful from a Buddhist point of view. There's another aspect for that as well, is that if the other person might die, and imagine how you'd feel if that was your last experience with them. And I will share a story about that, that I learned from my mother, who isn't a Buddhist. But my mother grew up in Skipton in Yorkshire. And there was somebody in the street where she grew up, where one day, it was a couple of doors down from where she lived with my mum and dad. And this lady had a really bad argument with her husband, and he'd left the house and then been hit by a car and killed. And you can just imagine the suffering that must have caused to that woman. Obviously, it would be awful. But my mum always used to relay this story to us that she'd learned through her mum from this family. And again, it shows how it can actually, in the long run, maybe help others with that kind of experience, because this woman had shared this story with my grandma and with other people. And my mum was always very, very strong on this. If we ever had a row as a family, to make sure that we absolutely sorted it out before we separated again. And I always found that a very, very powerful teaching. And as I say, my mother wasn't actually a Buddhist herself, although she's a very spiritual person. And it's a good thing probably to bear in mind. We don't know how long we've got together. We never really do, for sure. Particularly important relationships, that one, I think. And then the seventh one is reflecting on emptiness and selflessness. Now, that can be very, very helpful. Again, it's a huge subject, emptiness, and I'm not going to go into it in any detail now. But reflecting that things don't exist as permanently or as inherently, and understanding the role our mind is playing within the creation of different situations and things, that things, people, objects aren't inherently bad or useless, as they might feel sometimes when we're angry, can be very, very helpful. It's also a very, very good time to catch our sense of eye, which tends to be very, very strong if we're feeling angry. I talked yesterday about how this exaggerated notion of I is something very solid and separate and independent. From a Buddhist point of view, is the root of all our problems. The first step to making the teachings on emptiness and selflessness really effective is to actually see that and catch it. And times like that, where we're angry, can be a very, very good opportunity to do that. There's a really strong sense of I. It then makes all the other practices we do in relation to selfless and emptiness more meaningful, because they're actually directed at something that we're experiencing. So again, that's another way of how we can turn the situation around into a positive opportunity from the point of view of our practice. Point eight is trying to empathise with the other person. This obviously particularly applies when we feel angry towards people. And particularly, just reflect on times when you may have done similar things in the past, the way that person's acting now. If we check, we'll probably find perhaps not the same or to the same degree necessarily, but we're probably, if we're really, really honest, and that helps us empathise and be more understanding. Also, the more we understand Buddhist teachings generally and things like karma and the Four Noble Truths, the more we understand that the person's actually harming themselves if they're acting very negatively. And that in the long run, and again, this is a slow process. We can't expect too much too quickly, but it means compassion is more likely to arise than anger. And so that can be quite helpful. Port nine here is talking things through with the other person. And that's very, very important if we have the opportunity to do that. Sometimes It's better though, just to let it go. And I think somebody was talking about that yesterday briefly. It's better just to let it go. It's not always effective. It depends. I mean, some people are so sort of full of negative energy and stuff talking through them will only make things worse. So again, it's a question of being skillful that. But particularly if it's with a family member or a friend or something like that, it's very, very important. We try and talk things through if we can. It's very important when you're doing that, though, that you check your motivation and you aren't just doing it to still to prove that you're right and so on, which, again, can happen in relationships if you're not careful when you try to resolve something afterwards. Point 10 on here is there are lots of meditations we can apply as antidotes to anger. On love, compassion, equanimity, exchanging self for others, which I'm going to do with us later, and Sarah's going to do on love. And again, I've put on the list there that referred people to Kathleen for explanations of those. Another one, point 11, is, and this one actually came out of a discussion in Bath, and this is drawing inspiration from other beings who have experienced race, injustice and difficulties. And people who tend to be mentioned, Nelson Mandela comes up quite a lot, obviously His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. I mean, Gandhi, I think, was always a good example. There are some incredibly inspiring stories of people who went through the Holocaust in the war, for instance, who've come to realise the importance of forgiveness and moving on with compassion and things like that. And, you know, and if they can do it in those situations, you know, this gives us some inspiration that we can do the same. And that one actually came out from a discussion in Bath. And then the last one on the list here is identifying specific triggers when anger is likely to arise. And that's one that I think is quite important. And that doesn't just apply to anger. There might be certain situations when anger is more likely. In my case, a really big one for me for years was my computer, when I worked on my computer. And particularly, I used to do quite a lot of online tutoring, so I used to be on my computer quite a lot. I'm not the most IT literate person in the world. And nearly always the problems actually were due to my own IT ignorance. But I have to be careful then. I go in thinking I'm going to do something quite quickly, and then the computer starts playing up. And I find that quite frustrating. At one time, that was a really big source of anger for me. But I found, reminding myself of that when I was going into that situation, right, you're not going to get angry. This might not go the way you want. It might take a bit longer than you expect. Just reminding myself of that before I went into that situation, I found very, very helpful. And it's improved enormously as a result of that and other things. I mean, also with certain people can be triggers. There might be people in our families, people in our work, neighbours, if you've got difficult neighbours, things like that. And it doesn't just apply to anger, that it could apply to jealousy, for instance. There are certain people or certain situations that might trigger jealousy in our mind. And again, if we become aware of that, we can work with that and make us try and really, really enhance our mindfulness when we're going into those kinds of situations and with people. Okay, that's it. I know I've rattled through that a bit, but that's been quite deliberate because I want to get us discussing now. What I'm encouraging people to do, and I want to keep this very, very general, just share approaches that you found useful in dealing with things like this. It doesn't necessarily have to be anger, as I said. It could be depression, it could be jealousy, it could be fear, it could be attachment. There are lots of other things. You know, the main subject this weekend is dealing with the difficult emotions. So some of you may well have particular things you want to bring into this and share and discuss. So just share that in an open way. And as I say, try and be honest, try and talk about specific things if you can. I often think this kind of sharing is kind of a kind of generosity. And it's always helpful to others, I think, if people share honestly like this. And don't be too modest either. If you found things very successful in the past, you know, feel free to bring those up. I'm sure everybody here has got stuff to offer with this. Okay, so is that clear regarding the subject we're discussing? Faye's going to post that up as well. It's already there. Oh, it's already there, apparently. Right. And we shall come back.
How many minutes for the room?
Right, 20 minutes. Again, could somebody take responsibility for feeding back? And I think what we'll do, we'll then have the break and then we'll come back from the break and do the feedback after then. But again, could one person take responsibility just for taking a few notes and feeding back? Okay, so we've got 20 minutes. Fine.
You're on groups of four, so you know you've got some people in with you. Okay.
Yeah. Lovely. I'll see you back in 20 minutes.